As we get to the end of 2021, a lot of us can look back and think, gosh, I spent a lot of time this year sitting in one place. And if you think you could put that down to the pandemic, my next guest agrees with you. However, which pandemic could be up for debate? Peter Walker is a political correspondent for The Guardian in the UK and the author of The Miracle Pill, Why a Sedentary World is Getting It All Wrong. And Peter, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you very much. Hello, good morning.
Good morning to you. Good evening to you. And Peter, you argue we're experiencing a pandemic of inactivity rather than just the coronavirus. And I've got to say that using the word pandemic in this context seems a little alarmist given what we're experiencing globally. Do you want to defend your views on that?
Well, I do. I mean, a pandemic is something which is all around us, which causes illness, you know, and causes a large number of, you know, serious illnesses and deaths. And physical inactivity very, very much does that. I mean, it's difficult to estimate even just the number of deaths around the world because, you know, it's obviously not a primary source. It's not in the same way that COVID is a direct source of death. Right. But it causes things. It makes you much more likely to get a whole range of things like, you know, problems with your heart, certain types of cancer, lung disease, diabetes type 2, lots of kind of chronic ailments too. But the best estimate that's ever been done, which is probably a kind of very low estimate, is every year conditions connected to inactive living kill about 5.3 million people a year. And that's basically every single year. And it's something which is getting worse.
That's globally. So you're talking about there,
yes,
5.3 million?
That's around the world.
Right.
5.3 million around the world. And it's probably much more than that. I mean, I talked to one scientist who thinks it's probably close to about 7 or 8 million, probably.
I mean, those figures are both alarming and incredibly depressing. And I wanted just to tell people that we do have some ideas and strategies later on as to how we can start reversing those trends in our sedentary lifestyles.
Easy.
Yeah, yeah. And Peter has done it and he's very self-effacing about his own physical fitness at some stages in his life and what he's changed around that. And we'll get to that soon. But Peter, before we do, and I'm going to ask people to call, no, not call him, but text in a moment, but just for people like me to understand, how do you define inactivity? At what levels does our lifestyle become inactive?
There is a kind of scientific definition which the World Health Organization and most national health organizations use too. Australia's got the same one. It's basically that if you're doing less than 150 minutes a week, which is 2.5 hours a week, of moderate physical activity. And that doesn't have to be anything too strenuous. It could be a brisk walk. It could be, you know, doing something like gardening, or it could be, you know, digging a garden or kind of things like that. Anything that kind of exerts you a bit that doesn't get you particularly out of breath. If you do at least 150 minutes a week of that, then that's the minimum you should be doing. You should ideally also, particularly as you age, be doing some kind of muscle or weight bearing exercise about a couple of times a week.
Yeah.
And I mean, the scientific consensus is anything less than that, your health odds are less good. However, the very, very important message, which is emerging in new research all the time, is almost anything is better than nothing. So even if you don't do that, even if you only do 30 minutes a week, that's still much better than doing nothing at all.
As we talk about this, I'd very much like to hear about your activity levels over the last couple of years. And for so many of us, and we'll discuss it here as well, COVID has played a role, either for good or for ill, I have to say, because it depends on who you are and your age group and your lifestyle. But have you managed to keep doing something regularly over the last couple of years? Did the closure of gyms challenge you in terms of activity levels, and what has helped you get moving? Very much like to hear your thoughts on all of this. And Peter, in your book, you write about a study that's attempted to quantify not only the total number of deaths, but also the kinds of activity that people self-report. And there was one out of the UK where you live that was quite startling.
Well, there's quite a few. I mean, the UK is interesting. It's probably about average or slightly below average in global terms. But England in particular is very, very good at collecting quite detailed stats on this. There's a few that kind of surprised me quite a lot because, you know, I knew a certain amount about this when I started to research a book, but not that much. But I think the one that shocked me the most was that there's this travel survey that the UK government does every year, which is based on answers from a panel of 15,000 people. And they asked them all how many times in the previous year had you walked continuously for at least 20 minutes. So that's kind of walking a mile or slightly less. And just under 20% said they'd done it less than once, i.e. they'd never done it. In the previous year, they'd not walked 20 minutes or so at a time, even a single time. And it's quite easy for people to do that, you know, because we do live in a world where, particularly if you live on a main road or there's not good pavements or not good buses or trains, it's very easy to use a car for every single, you know, stop that you do, going to the shops, going to work, going to all the places. And it can slip into a routine. It's quite difficult to get out of that.
And it goes to the heart as well of real deficiencies in urban planning, I would have thought.
Yes, it very, very, very much does. I mean, this is the whole thing that one of the key messages I tried to get across in the book is that whilst we're obviously all ultimately responsible for how active we are, there's all sorts of societal forces which bear down on us, and people aren't necessarily to blame. You know, so for example, the bulk of the physical activity I do is that I ride a bike. But yeah. I live in London where there's some bike lanes. I'm a middle-aged man, which is the demographic most likely to do it. And there's a lot of people who think, you know, cycling to work would be great. And they get on a bike. And the first time someone close passes them at 40 miles an hour, they think, oh, my goodness, this is crazy. And they maybe quite sensibly think that they're never even going to try it for a second time. So that option is suddenly closed off. And it could be that, I don't know, that if your children want to walk to school, but the route isn't particularly safe, then you don't let them do them. So they drive. So there's all sorts of societal forces which, you know, affect what we do.
Indeed. And Peter, I want to come back to the role of individual choice and governmental responsibility as well, because I think it's a really interesting discussion around this in a moment. But before we do that, let's talk with someone else who's got some really interesting data and insights as to what Peter's observations from a UK perspective might mean in a place like Australia. Cathy Sherrington is a professor at the University of Sydney School of Public Health, and she specialises in physical activity, ageing and disability research. And Professor Sherrington, hello, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's been great to have you listening in as well, Cathy, because I know you have. What we've heard there from Peter's perspective in a UK sort of environment, and he's talking here, extrapolating that around the globe. Does it hit home as accurately here in Australia?
Yes, definitely. Very similar situation in Australia. Around half of Australians are not getting that amount of physical activity that's required for health. There's no evidence that it's improving over time, unfortunately. That 50% has been quite consistent for quite some years. And unfortunately, the people who could probably gain most from being more active, older people and people with disabilities, are actually less active than the general population.
So there's lots of reasons why that occurs, but one of the most pressing ones has to be, surely, the impact of coronavirus on our restrictions of movement, lockdowns, isolation. Is it important for us to recognise that when we're trying to encourage people back out the door?
Yes, definitely. And in the UK, Muir Grace writes really compellingly about the deconditioning pandemic, which has accompanied the coronavirus pandemic. You know, really the idea that people's activity has been limited and as a result, they've lost fitness, lost strength and lost physical function. And that's particularly affected older people and people with disabilities. Australian data has actually found that, you know, for some individuals, people have been able to be more active during this difficult time, and some older people have been more active, but a greater number of people have unfortunately been less active in this lockdown time.
So, Cathy, while I don't want to be a Pollyanna about this, we do need some positivity and some optimism and some hope here. So as much as we might have deconditioned, no matter what lifestyle we might have led before coronavirus, how hard is it to recondition?
Well, it's a really good opportunity to recondition, as you say. You know, we can have a fresh start. I think people are feeling more positive about 2022. And, you know, we can be all taking that responsibility and looking to change our behaviour, sort of choosing activities that we enjoy, seeking help if necessary to get more active. But as you say, people are operating in the broader social context. So we do also need, you know, support from government funding programs and things to help us be more active.
Oh, that's very interesting. So let's get into this government responsibility stuff, because I think it's a real, as I said earlier, a very interesting part of this discussion. And if you've just joined us, my guest, Cathy Sherrington, who's a professor at the University of Sydney Schools of Public Health, and also with us from the UK is Peter Walker, political correspondent for The Guardian in the UK and author of The Miracle Pill, Why a Sedentary World is Getting It All Wrong. Peter, we could spend hours talking about why a political correspondent for The Guardian is talking to us about our own health, but we'll leave that aside. I do want to talk to you, though, about the title, Miracle Pill. Just explain to us why you chose to go that path in terms of naming this book.
Well, it's a kind of image. I mean, for people like Cathy, who are genuine experts in the field, it's a bit of a cliche. You know, it has been a bit of a cliche for quite a number of years in public health circles. That if you could turn the physical and, I guess, mental benefits of physical activity into a tablet, it would probably win several Nobel Prizes. I mean, you'd have an even chance of ending up on a kind of banknote within about 20 or 30 years, because it's just completely astonishing. The study that I use to kind of illustrate it in the book, it's quite a well-known study that was done in Denmark about 20 years ago, though curiously, the findings were replicated in the UK more or less exactly 20 years later. It took a big cohort of, from memory, about 15,000 Danish people of all ages and followed them over about 30 years.
Yeah.
And it looked at the ones who cycled to and from work, and this wasn't particularly far. This was about 15 minutes each way. And even when you factored out every other aspect of their lives, including kind of leisure time, sport, their diet, their other lifestyle factors, the people who cycled to and from work had a 40% less chance of dying during this 30-year period of the study than people who didn't. And again, if you think that, if you could package that into a tablet, if someone could take a tablet every day and have a 40% less chance of dying young, then that's completely astonishing. And that really is a miracle.
That is a miracle. But along with those findings from the Danish study now replicated in the UK, you make the point that if it was a pill, the governments of all persuasions would be falling over themselves to help us get them.
Yes. Well, they would. But the problem is, though, it's not a pill. It's something which is quite difficult. It's something which has been getting worse for about 50 or 60 years for all sorts of reasons, you know, some of which are actually good reasons. That a lot of the physical activity people used to do in their everyday lives was the very tedious domestic chores that women kind of mainly did, things like rug beating and carpet cleaning and mangling clothes and stuff like that. And no one's saying we should go back to that. But there's just been nothing that's taken its place. I mean, the ubiquity of cars has made it very, very less easy for people to cycle or walk, which is a big difference too. But for a government to change that, it needs maybe 20 or 30 years of concerted action. I talked to government ministers about, you know, why they don't do it. And one of the kind of most compelling reasons they gave is it just falls between so many different areas. Even if you want to get, say, people in a city active, is it about the transport department? Is it health department? Is it the community and urban planning department? It's kind of all of those and
the
more.
Answer is yes.
So but it's very, very difficult. That's and it takes a long time.
Cathy Sherrington, can I come to you on that as well? How do you think we need to progress this change in the way we view ourselves in relation to our activity levels when for so many decades, generations, we've been taught the less we have to expend energy on manual tasks, the more prosperous and advanced we are?
Yes, that's exactly right. Our society does not support us to be active. I mean, to me, the World Health Organization Global Action Plan on Physical Activity is really helpful. So it really talks about four different aspects of improving activity. So we need active societies. So we need sort of social norms that support people to be active. We need active environments. So that's what we were talking about with the bike paths, the walking paths, the, you know, toilets, seats near paths, to make them accessible. We need active people, which is supported by programs. So we need programs and opportunities across all sectors, sport, community sectors, everyone providing different types of programs so people can choose the program that works best for them. And we also need active systems. And so we need those sort of policies and the funding to actually support this infrastructure and this behaviour. Peter's right, it is very complex.
Yeah, and can I just push back and say, I'm not sure that governments are unaware of the importance of getting us off our bums and out there and engaging with the world, because pragmatically, if nothing else, they know that the more active we are, the less likely we are to end up in hospital with chronic diseases that perform a burden on our already extended health system during this time of pandemic crisis. I mean, I think they all get that, but the problem is we just don't listen very well. Isn't that one of the issues here, Kathy, is that health campaigns often fall on deaf ears?
I think that's right. I think we could have had more campaigns, though, and we also need the services behind those campaigns. It's not really enough just telling people to be active. We need to work out ways to support them to be more active as well.
Right.
And with what you were saying about the funding, a big challenge is that money for different consequences sort of comes from different pockets. And so we do know that at an overall system level, investing in physical activity would be cost effective, but the people running the programs are not necessarily the same people who are benefiting from those cost savings with the hospital admissions, for example.
If you're listening to this conversation and you'd like to weigh in, we'd very much like to hear from you from a personal perspective. What have you managed to do or not do in this last couple of years of lockdown? For example, there's some pretty strong evidence in some areas of our community that whereas younger people did less activity because of lockdowns and they tended to turn to digital screens, some of our older Australians, not everybody, but some older Australians found that the hour or 2 hours allotted to physical activity during lockdown sort of gave them a kind of structure, which meant they went out and did more than they had done before lockdowns and pandemic was part of our lives. So very much like to hear what you got up to, because of course gyms were closed for long periods of time in some states and territories. Peter, you, as you mentioned in your book and write, as I mentioned quite self-effacingly about, is you decided to actually overcome your own self-perception of not being active and not being very physical in your body, and you left behind a civil servant job, took up a job as a bike courier for 3 years, became almost superhuman, at least in your calf muscles, by the sound of things, and now gone back to a desk job. You had another measurement of your fitness, I think, only recently in the writing for this book. And while no one expects a middle-aged man to be the same as when you were 22, things were pretty good, weren't they, in that measurement?
Things weren't bad. I mean, there's all sorts of different things that you can do. I took a VO2 max test, which I'd...
Is that oxygen capacity?
This is basically the one that athletes take to see how much oxygen your lungs can process over a certain amount of time. Uh-huh. And it's a kind of as good a metric as there is for that kind of aerobic fitness. And I'd taken one for a separate project a couple of years earlier when I'd been doing a lot more cycling. And it was 53, which for my age was actually really good. It had gone down a bit. It was in the 40s. I've forgotten the exact amount it was. And I was quite disappointed that, you know, even though by any standards for my age, it was really good. But I don't know. It is quite strange because, you know, my journey is not necessarily a normal one. I went from in my early 20s doing almost nothing to doing this job where my ability to pay the rent, you know, relied on me cycling for about 10 hours a day. And when I write about this, I do stress that's not something I'd point, you know, that other people need to do. Even if you can only do 10 or 15 minutes a day, it will do you some good.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the thing. We've got to find ways to incorporate exercise into life as a normal thing, as opposed to, and this is the point you make. And Kathy, would I be right in thinking you feel the same, that we need to find a way to reincorporate activity in a way that gives us joy, provides the benefits, and we don't have to constantly think about it as an add-on or bolt-on to what we already do?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the evidence for the benefits of physical activity is so strong that we know that actually many different types of activity can be beneficial. So it really is about finding a way to move that works for you. And so for some people that will be incidental activity. So it will be during the day to, you know, really try and incorporate being more active within what you're doing. For other people that will actually be more structured exercise. So joining a class or, you know, joining a sporting team or something like that. It's really about finding what works best for you.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, obviously brisk walking is beneficial. And Kathy, if we do more than the 150 minutes a week recommended by the WHO, does it stand to reason we get more healthy?
Yes, it does. In fact, the latest WHO guidelines actually recommend up to 300 minutes a week, which is sort of around 45 minutes a day. Okay. But they do stress that there is benefits from some increase in activity. So they say every move counts.
I think that's hopeful. I must say, though, it does worry me that it sounds a little desperate because we're so sedentary that we're now thinking every move counts. But I take your point on this, and let's hope we can find our way back to that kind of movement if we've been a little sedentary over the last couple of years. It's been great to speak to both of you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
My guest today, Kathy Sherrington, who is a professor at the University of Sydney School of Public Health, specialising in physical activity, ageing and disability research, and with her, Peter Walker from the UK, political correspondent for The Guardian and the author of The Miracle Pill, Why a Sedentary World is Getting It All Wrong. And are you getting it all right? Let's find out from Erica Voles. What are you hearing, Erica?
I'm hearing a lot of people getting it all right, Michael.
Oh, great.
Case in point, Elizabeth says her device is her aid. It's her secret weapon. Lets you check your daily activity and compete with yourself. I'm now at 151 consecutive days of reaching 10,000 steps.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wow. This hasn't been the impact for another listener. Yes, the breaking of my 6 a.m. gym routine has been a setback. I'm 62. Kim says, thanks for the program. I've found less time commuting has enabled me to do online yoga with Adrian. You're not alone there, Kim. And more walking, definitely a big advantage of COVID. But yep. She says public safety for women needs to be addressed. Margaret That's says, I'm 65. Since I retired, I use public transport unless I need to transport something, like the cat. I take stairs whenever they're there. I'm surprised at the amount of young people using escalators. And Louise says on text, I'm in my late 40s. I loved playing sport with my friends, tennis and netball. COVID ended all of that, so I made a plan with a friend who lives nearby and we meet up and run in the forest. Regardless of the weather, over the past 2 years, we've gotten wet, bruised, muddy, sunburnt, but it was so good for our physical and mental health. And this week we got back into netball and it was delightful. And I'll have more comments for you later. So many positive comments on this one.
That's great. That's what we like to hear. Erica Voles there, back later after the Too Hard Basket. You're listening to Life Matters. My name's Michael McKenzie, and in a moment, a honest talk and discussion about what we love to do during summer, and that's going swimming.